The Center for Disease Control and Prevention says closing the schools to prevent the spread of swine flu is no longer necessary. And the word mild is being used. Are we out of the woods? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Antiviral medication is making its way to the bush, and work on a vaccine is underway. Our number, 1-800-478-8255, toll-free in Anchorage, a local call, 550-8422, email talk@aprn.org. Got questions about H1N1 2009? Stay tuned to Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Alaska Communications Systems, serving Alaskans across the state with vital telecommunications since before statehood. ACS, providing voice and high-speed broadband solutions, connects Alaska to the rest of the world. EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and a sustainable salmon population in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/copper river. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Well, we're joined by Dr. Jay Butler. He is the Chief Medical Officer for the state of Alaska. Jay, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning, Steve. It's good to be here.
We kind of figured that, you know, this story changes every day. But last week we said, well, let's just give the state an opportunity to take advantage of being able to reach a statewide audience and have kind of an extended discussion of this this H1N1, or swine flu, as it was called, and I guess still is.
Yep, and that name certainly says a lot about what we know about the virus. I guess a more technically correct term might be swine origin, but it's a virus that adapted from pigs to be able to infect humans. It actually appears to have at least four different sources right now, both components of human influenza, which is part of what makes it able to infect people, at least two different strains from swine, and maybe even a few genetic segments from birds. So some people are calling it a quadrimix at this time. And this can occur naturally. It's part of the way influenza behaves in nature.
Well, I'm looking at the hospitalization numbers that came out from CDC today, and there were 35 hospitalized and 200. Sometimes it's 279, sometimes it's 286 cases. But whichever it is, it's bound to go up because lab results are out. And as they come in, you're going to get some more positives, I would think.
And I could actually update that from about 2 hours ago. The daily count of confirmed cases is 403 nationally. It's important to realize that that's really reflecting numbers from people who first presented to medical care about a week ago. So that number, it really reflects the number of people who were getting sick about a week ago now. Nationwide, there's well over 1,000 probable cases, people who have influenza that could not be typed out in their state health lab, probably reflecting the fact that they indeed have the 2009 H1N1. So those numbers will increase.
Do we have any more fatalities than them one child in Texas?
So far, only one death.
So the word mild is being used. I'm looking at this hospitalization rate, which I assume went over 35. It's a fairly substantial number of people.
Right. I mean, if we had to describe it clinically, I think it's fair to say it's not a cold, it's the flu, but it's not Ebola either. This is not the Andromeda strain. The hospitalization rate actually is a little higher than what we see with seasonal flu. So I'm a little hesitant to say it's no worse than the seasonal flu because we're fairly early on and we're still confirming cases. But overall, it looks like it's on par, maybe more on par with what happened with the pandemics in 1957 and 1968. One thing that I think everybody needs to be aware of when we're talking about mild, we're talking about the illness, not the spread of the infection. It is very transmissible. I mean, if we were in marketing and we wanted to take something and go from two states to 38 states in 12 days, we'd really have something. I think the only thing that spread faster is that picture on the internet of the kid licking the pig's snout.
Hmm. Well, it's speaking of pigs, this is something I wanted to ask you about because apparently there was a worker who had the disease who went to a pig farm in Alberta, and that's basically it's where that outbreak started. So,
yes.
So it was transmitted, this we're calling swine flu, was transmitted then to a person who then transmitted it back to the swine.
Yes, and that's very well documented now. Isolates from those pigs have been evaluated both in Health Canada and at the CDC labs, and they are the identical strain to what is causing human disease really throughout North America right now. So while you can't get the infection from eating pork, the virus does appear to be capable of being passed back and forth between humans and pigs.
So where do we stand? I mean, I was talking to somebody who had a relative that was going to Mexico. And she said, well, should I try and get that Tamiflu or what? And I didn't have an answer for that.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of questions buried there. One is travel advisories. Currently, the federal government is advising that travel to Mexico be delayed or even canceled unless it's really essential travel. That may very well change as this continues to go along, because at some point that's not really going to limit the spread. That travel advisory was issued a little over a week ago when the majority of cases in the United States were occurring among people returning from travel in Mexico. That is no longer the case. The best place to get the H1N1 in the United States is in the United States right now. I think Dr. Besser from the CDC said it pretty well. It's not coming across the border. It's coming from across the street.
So it's here probably. It's probably in Alaska.
We have not identified it yet in Alaska. We're certainly looking very hard. But a nice thing is we've had a little bit of lead time to set up the capacity to be able to confirm infection with this virus in Alaska. When we get our first positives, we'll be reconfirming those with the lab in Atlanta. But as states get more and more experience, increasingly those confirmations won't be done in Atlanta. They'll be done in the various state health labs around the country. And we will have that capacity as well.
So is this part of the state virology lab expertise that was brought into the state when there started to be concerns about bird flu? Is that where the testing is being done, or is this a simpler process?
Yes, and I'd like to say how glad I am that we have the new virology lab. When I back 4 or 5 years ago, when I was going around giving a lot of talks about influenza because there was concerns about bird flu, I used to talk about the importance of hand hygiene, and I used a photograph of praying hands. And I used to always say that was Dr. Bonsager, who was director of public health at that time, praying that we don't have a pandemic till that new virology lab is completed in Fairbanks. And that lab is up and operating now. The grand opening isn't actually scheduled till next month, but it's in full operation now.
So a person is feeling sick. And I imagine there's people listening right now who say, do I have it? Am I feeling the first symptoms? What would be the point where a person would want to go to a physician to take the next step in terms of the symptoms that they were seeing?
Well, the most important thing in deciding whether or not to see a healthcare provider, whether that be a physician or nurse practitioner or the village health aide, is the severity of the illness, because there's nothing unique about this influenza that will distinguish it from other types of influenza.
Ah.
And we have influenza right now in Alaska. We had 20 isolates using the PCR technique in the state virology lab last week. Three of them were actually H1N1, but they were the same H1N1 strains that have been circulating in Alaska all winter long. They were not the new so-called swine flu strain. So the cardinal symptoms to watch for are things like shortness of breath, particularly if we're talking about a child, if there's any loss of color, particularly bluishness around the lips, feeling of fullness in the chest or the belly. Those are the kind of things that would make us worry about it being a more severe manifestation of infection. And that someone should be evaluated by – I mean, it's not just a matter of making the diagnosis. It's a matter of getting medical care. We mentioned antiviral drugs a little earlier, and, you know, that's an area where we've tried to make sure that we have the surge capacity to be able to provide those medications if they're needed. I think the good news is what seems to be emerging is that because this is a relatively mild infection – and I'm on radio, so no one can see I'm making quotation marks here – It's probably going to be used primarily for treatment of more severe cases. And the as you mentioned, things change every day. They really change every hour. And as more information is collected, we hope to be able to identify those people who would be at greatest risk of developing severe infection so that they might be able to get medication as early as possible if needed. The vast majority of cases, though, have recovered without any antiviral medication at all.
There's a – do we know the incubation period? Do all flus have a similar incubation period?
Well, this flu appears to behave –
I guess incubation isn't the right word, right? The bacteria works.
No, but viruses incubation period also. If we're using incubation period to describe the period between exposure to onset of illness. And for this virus, it appears to be in the range of about 2 days to 5 days. So it's fairly fast, and that's part of the reason why it spreads so quickly is you become sick and infectious fairly quickly. An important related question is, at what point do you become infectious? It's very clear from our experience with usual seasonal influenza that people who are sick are infectious. They do begin to shed some virus sometimes a matter of hours before they become ill, but it's not real clear what role that may play in transmission. So one of the very important control measures are, if you're sick, stay home. Don't share the joy with others.
Yeah, you know, the Homeland Security Secretary Napolitano and the president are both saying, look, this is really important. If you are sick, you should stay home. And some people can't. You know, I mean, this is one of these areas where people that, don't have sick days. I mean, and you could see where there'd be a problem if it's your nanny.
Right. Well, that's where the message needs to go, not just to the workers, but also to the employers, that they understand how important that is. I know a number of the larger employers in Alaska have thought about this ahead of time and have developed contingency plans. And I certainly would like to take this opportunity to point out to anyone who hasn't developed a contingency plan to think about how are you going to deal with absenteeism, and also stress the importance of perhaps being liberal with sick leave, because people who are sick really should not be at work, because then your workforce may really be challenged if all of everyone is sick at once, not to mention your customers.
Well, we're talking with Dr. Jay Butler. He's the chief medical officer of the state of Alaska. And so far, there have been no confirmed cases of this H1N1 swine flu. Complicating things is that there's another H1N1, we find out.
We could call it 2009 H1N1 and be very technically correct. Swine flu, we can use for the purpose of conversation.
All right. Well, let's do that then. So what if for a healthcare provider, what are the guidelines that they're operating on now in terms of whether they should obtain a sample? What kind of sample do they obtain? And what happens next, and how long does it take? How's that for a long question?
Well, right now in Alaska, we would really encourage healthcare providers to collect samples from anyone who has flu-like illness, because we really want to know the status of the virus in Alaska, when it's arrived, where it's arrived, and how it's spreading. Once it's in a community, that type of sampling really isn't quite as critical. One of the factors that's evolving very quickly are the methods of rapid diagnosis. It appears that most people in the lower 48 who've confirmed to have the 2009 virus have also had rapid influenza tests. And so that may actually prove to be a useful tool to decide who should get antiviral meds or who you think may actually have the swine 2009 virus.
So would you run that by me again? Because I didn't quite get it.
Sure. Actually, maybe if you could rephrase the question, maybe I can rephrase the answer better.
Okay. Well, I started saying what's the clinic if someone presents with the symptoms? What's the guidelines for presenting for sending a sample in for testing? You're saying, well, if it's already in the community, it's not that important anymore because we already know it's there. But right now, we want those samples. And then we went on with there's a faster test, and you were saying that the people who are presenting, who are being diagnosed with the faster test, that this may do the job.
Yeah, thank you for that for clarifying question, because I did muddle that. Currently, our request is that specimens be collected from people with influenza-like illness and be submitted to the state public health lab for PCR testing for influenza. And that's how we can do the screening to determine whether or not it may be the 2009 virus. That's particularly important in people who have positive tests for influenza A. And in fact, I can add that people who have rapid tests for influenza B don't need to be tested, because that seems to be a pretty good rule out. Now, these rapid tests are what's currently commercially available. Many providers have in their office. It's not designed for this virus. It's designed to detect influenza A, influenza B in broad terms, but it appears to detect many of the infections with the 2009 virus. I really need to stress that is the answer at 10:15 right. on May 5th, 2009, because the clinical information is coming in fast and furious, and we will continue to update those recommendations for clinicians as time goes on.
Wow. You know, it strikes me that and of course, you know, this almost goes without saying, but still, you're walking a kind of a delicate line. Because there's so much, you say, there's a quick, easy over-the-counter test, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, if all the public health officers are saying all that on the radio, somebody's going to make a whole lot of money. You know, kind of like with Tamiflu, you know, the blogs are full of all this. Well, you know, Donald Rumsfeld is a stockholder in the Tamiflu company, and there's this other company that is in a foreign country that makes the other drug, and which one should be mentioned first? And, you know, a lot hangs on, I guess it expires after a certain length of time. So the federal government has bought this huge stockpile now, and some of it's expiring. And it just all gets pretty complicated.
Yeah. Let me actually touch on two topics that you raised. One is be on the alert that some of the products out there being sold may not be all that good. They may be overpriced. I know particularly things purchased through the internet is where I would have concern. There are family protection kits that sometimes are not much more other than gloves, some surgical masks, and some hand wipes. And there's a remarkable markup on those items that you could just get yourself at the grocery store for probably 1/100th of the cost of what's being charged. The question of shelf life of antiviral medications is a good one. The federal stockpiles come under a federal program that allows continual testing of those medications to ensure that they are still potent. The state stockpiles do not come under that program currently, and we are working very hard with the federal government to try and include our stockpiles so that the shelf life could be continued even longer. At present, the shelf life is 7 years. So we are good for a number of years yet with the stockpiles that we have in state. But the longer we can make those good, the better.
Wow. So there's kind of an ongoing process of deciding what the shelf life is? Because I heard it 3 years.
Yeah. Basically, the original labeling was 5 years. And then subsequent to that, there was testing that some experiments done under a variety of storage situations that led the FDA to extend the shelf life to 7 years. In the federal stockpiles, there's actually a program where they sample the drugs. There's also very restrictive conditions for storage, and they will test for potency. So it's actually an ongoing method of saying this lot is still good, and we can continue to use this without rotating it out.
Thank you, Dr. J. Butler. It's a delicate situation you're in, I can tell. Do you think we are approaching an epidemic peak in the United States? Can we tell?
I really think it's too early. When we look at how seasonal flu enters communities, if we look at pandemics from the past, we're usually looking 6 to 8 weeks out for a peak. We're really only in the second week now. If you're counting confirmed cases, we're really confirming cases that occurred during the first week. So I think we will see the numbers go up quite a bit. I think the numbers will become misleading too, though, because already areas where there's been more transmission, such as New York City, they're not testing people with influenza-like illness. They're really focusing on the people who appear to be more severely ill. So those numbers probably really underestimate the real number of people who are sick in the city. The more telling thing, I think, will be looking at the number of states involved and the number of countries involved, and that'll really show us how this spreads around the world. It's not officially a pandemic until WHO goes to level 6. We're at level 5 right now. The threshold for going to level 6, however, is seeing the degree of transmission that we're seeing already in North America on another continent. So WHO going to level 6 doesn't change anything of what we're doing in this country or in Canada or in Mexico.
I heard there might be a concern about the Southern Hemisphere, that as this virus enters the Southern Hemisphere, it's going to hit an existing flu season. And there was even some suggestion of evolutionary competition between different kinds of flu.
Yeah, and again, you have two very important points. One is influenza tends to be more severe during the winter months, which is December, January through April in the Northern Hemisphere, opposite in the Southern Hemisphere. May through September, October, that's the flu season in places like Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. In the tropics, it tends to be more of a year-round phenomenon. So there's a seasonality as you get into the temperate zones that's never really been fully explained. We will certainly be watching with great interest what goes on in South America and in Oceania and in Africa to see how this virus behaves during their flu season. And also the WHO, through their global surveillance, will be collecting viral isolates to see if the virus has changed, which certainly is one of the concerns. If this virus is unstable, if it's adapting one way or the other, also is it passing back and forth between humans and pigs such that it could perhaps be reemerging as yet a new virus? One of the unique things about pigs is they have receptors in their respiratory tract to accept both human and bird influenza strains. So even 20, 25 years ago, people used to sometimes talk about pigs as the mixing vessel for influenza viruses, that the cells that become infected with influenza, it's very possible then for a cell to become infected with two strains at once. It's a simple genome, 8 strands. Think of it almost like a deck of cards that can then get shuffled and put together into a new virus. That infected cell will burst, usually in a period of about 10 to 12 hours, and release 100,000 to 1,000,000 virus particles. So that's how sometimes these things develop and can develop very explosively.
Well, you're making me scared of pork again.
Well, I hope I'm not. We should all have some pork enchiladas on Cinco de Mayo. This is not a disease that's unique to Latin America, and it's not a disease that you acquire by eating pork.
So what happened? What happens to all that virus? Let's say you got a pig that's infected. It's slaughtered. There's meat. How come there is not a problem?
The virus is primarily in the respiratory tract of the pig. So the way it spreads from pigs to humans then is exposure to live swine. I don't know what happened to that kid who licked the pig's snout. I hope that was a healthy pig.
Yeah, me too.
I hope his parents are getting some money from that photo.
Dr. Jay Butler is our guest. He is the chief medical officer for the state of Alaska. We're talking about the H1N1 2009 virus and what the precautions ought to be and where things are likely to go. And it's all guesswork. I mean, it's all the best guess right now. 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Our local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, and it's talk@aprn.org on the email. And we do have a call, but I wanted to go back to something you said. A few days ago, and this changes every day, they were starting to think, about Saturday, I think, that maybe this isn't too communicable. I guess I heard you say, no, actually, this is fairly easily transmissible disease.
Yeah, I think that's really been a maybe a miscommunication or a misunderstanding. And
well, there's been plenty of it.
There, that does happen. I think most likely it's probably the phenomenon of how mild has been used. Does that mean it doesn't spread easily? Does that mean it causes relatively mild disease? And it's really the latter, but the virus itself seems to spread fairly easily, just like all other human influenza viruses do.
So pretty much, as far as we can tell right now, pretty much like a seasonal flu.
Right.
But the biggest, would a person know? Would a person know? Would be able to distinguish one from the other?
No, you couldn't.
Huh.
If you have headache, fever, chills, body ache, you couldn't distinguish this strain from seasonal flu.
Wow. So for epidemiologically, then, this becomes very difficult.
It is a challenge.
Because you have to wait for people to be hospitalized just to see what the symptoms are and then to get the test results back and then kind of guess, really.
Well, it's one of the reasons why there's active work going on to be able to answer these questions. It's not a matter of just waiting to get reports from hospitals, but there's clinical teams in a number of states that have outbreaks right now to be able to answer that question, as well as a team from the CDC and the Ministry of Health in Mexico down there trying to answer the question of why did it appear to be more severe early on. We don't have a really clear answer to that question yet, but the most likely explanation is they had a whole lot of influenza and that the more mild cases had gone undetected.
Hmm. Well, speaking of Mexico, I was looking at the figures on deaths from Mexico, and every time I look, they go down. I think they were up in the hundreds, like 600 at one point, and now they're down to 25.
Yeah, and I believe those are deaths that are confirmed in the lab. So it's important to realize that, you know, people who died 3 weeks ago, there's not going to be any testing. They're never going to be confirmed.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Oh, good point. Well, let's go to Pam, joins the program from Anchorage. Pamela, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Oh, thank you. I do science for the unorganized borough and have been looking into pandemics and preparedness for some time. I also just got back from Massachusetts and New England, where they've been dealing with the latest flu. They've had a number of cases confirmed up there. And one of the opening questions was whether Alaska was prepared or not. And I think that we actually are not. The preparedness is kind of patchy. The state and some of our health corporations have done what I consider a fairly poor job of being prepared and getting people prepared. Part of that is getting information out so that individuals can make an accurate assessment of what their own risk is, and that's been our biggest lack. But then there are other things such as, we had the state issued an official pass to a mass disease shelter, but that shelter doesn't exist. So why do we issue passes to the shelter?
Well, where is it? It doesn't exist, but can you clarify what you're talking about in terms of a pass?
Yes, this is a little card that was issued by the Department of Health from the state and the health corporation. It was entitled the bearer to go to mass disease shelter.
Oh yeah, so, Dr. Butler is shaking his head.
I'm yeah, shrugging because I honestly don't know. I have not seen one of these cards.
Well,
not related to this outbreak.
I have a picture posted at ykalaska.wordpress.com, and which is where I've been trying to put information because we just weren't getting it out in the unorganized borough. Now, another example that I think is quite interesting is the use of masks. And we saw with the volcano, people were preparing, getting masks and using them. The masks are all don't fit. You can't tell if they fit or not for many people. There are big gaps in it. Nobody knows how to use it.
And that's a really great point, Pam. That is a really good point.
We have alternatives, but I can't get anybody in Alaska to help me test what would be a very useful alternative for people who are old and young, you know, Asian, Anglo-American, Alaska Native. and would be much more useful if the state's going to hand out masks to its employees because of the volcano. They're not giving instructions on how to use it. You know, one size doesn't fit anybody hardly.
Dr. Butler, maybe you can clarify for me, but I'm not sure that these masks do too much about a virus anyway.
Yeah, just to go back through what the primary recommendations for prevention of influenza are, hand hygiene is the big thing. Being able to wash hands or use waterless hand cleaner really makes a difference. Some of that's microbiological studies that have been done in the lab. Also observational in real-world situations. It was found that during the SARS outbreak in Asia, for instance, when there was an emphasis on hand hygiene, transmission of influenza actually was reduced. The other things that are important for prevention, and these are the big three, there's more I could certainly go into as we go on, is what we call respiratory etiquette. If you are sick, sneezing into your elbow or, yeah, it's somebody was describing to me, teaching kids to do it, it's kind of like Count Dracula pulling your arm up across your face for the cough or the sneeze. And it does two things. One is it helps spare the hands where the virus can actually stay viable for a period of minutes and could potentially be passed. Also, it doesn't survive very well on cloth. And the third thing is just what we were discussing earlier, the importance of staying home if you're sick and not spreading the infection. Now, the question of masks is a very good one. For influenza, we really don't have a recommendation for using masks in the community. There's not a lot of evidence that it provides any protection. And part of that may be because of just the situation you were describing. As a healthcare provider, I go through a process of fit testing when I'm using a mask to make sure it fits appropriately so that there's not the kind of gaps that you're describing. And if you go to our website, you will not find recommendations that everybody should go out wearing masks. The one exception is that if you are sick and you must go out, a mask can be used basically as a splatter shield. So a surgical mask is fine. The idea is to keep the secretions to yourself rather than being able to easily move them. Now, in terms of information, I'm also very glad you mentioned that. We have activated or reactivated the state website, which is pandemicflu.alaska.gov. You'll find information for Alaska there. You'll also find links to the CDC information as well as the WHO information. In terms of preparedness in Alaska, I think, you know, the question of preparedness to me is never a black, white, yes, no, one or zero. It's a process. And we are much more prepared now than we were 5 years ago. And we've really had quite a partnership both with the municipalities and with the tribal organizations.
Pamela, I'm sure you have more. Dr. J. Butler, the Chief Medical Officer of the State of Alaska, is our guest as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from TelAlaska, a telecommunications company proud to support public broadcasting, sharing the spirit of communications across the Great Land. Voice data and Wi-Fi technologies at TelAlaska, on the web at telalaska.com.
Well, now, you may think that one of those face masks will protect you from getting the swine flu, but it's not. It's going to contain your snot, though. I thought maybe that'd be a way to remember it. Dr. J. Butler, the Chief Medical Officer for the State of Alaska, is with us, and on the telephone is Pamela, trying to make sure that that the unorganized burrow, i.e. the bush, is getting the word. Pam, did you have more for us?
Well, the other thing which I think is a real danger is that people become complacent or think that they're safe when they're not. And so if people are making efforts to disinfect doorknobs, if you have a public building, make sure you use the proper solutions and you do it regularly. It doesn't do any good to do it once and then think you're safe. The same is true with those masks, is if you're going to issue them, make sure people understand when they're useful and when they aren't. On the other hand, we have state employees that need to go to work, are working with the public. They may try to wear something to keep other people from getting, you know, when you breathe out, you get all those droplets full of various bugs and things. And you, they can't wear them because people get upset you're wearing a mask in public.
Yeah.
So there's some very, there's some odd things. It's incomplete, I guess, is the real issue here. And it's incomplete even in Anchorage, where it's not, you know, even within the state system, it's an incomplete information, lack of practice. And the big thing I saw back east was that they were closing schools, some, most of them unnecessarily. But when they closed schools, all the parents set up communal playgroups, you know.
So it's the same thing. It's the same thing without sanitizing the doorknobs.
Yeah. You know, and where are your school plans? Everybody in Alaska needs to know where their school plans are and make sure they're followed, or make sure they have them and then make sure that they're useful.
Pam, you're an absolute gold mine. I want to thank you for your call.
You're very welcome. And it's Kung Fu Chew. There's a little movie even showing how you sneeze into your sleeve and just remember Kung Fu.
Kung Fu, okay.
I have seen that. That is a good one, Pam. Thank you.
Right. Yeah.
Thanks a lot for your call. Yeah, you were taking notes there.
Right. I think Pam made a good observation about the school closures. I think she made the comment whether it was needed or not. Some schools decided to do that. Of course, that was recommended consideration to do it nationally until just a few hours earlier, as you pointed out when we first came on the air, Steve. And the reason for that was severalfold. One was that a number of the early outbreaks were in schools, particularly among students who had recently returned from class trips to Mexico. Second, it did seem to be a lot of transmission within schools. And it's probably worth pointing out that still two-thirds of the confirmed cases are in kids 18 and younger. So far, this really hasn't impacted particularly the 65 and older population. And we can certainly discuss some of the possibilities for that. The third was that we know kids are play an important role in transmission of seasonal influenza also. So if there's a lot of transmission going on in the schools, that's a concern. And if we can interrupt that, that may buy us some time. All that said, as we have observed over the past week, there were issues such as Pam described as, well, the kids just gather elsewhere. And there's actually mathematical models that have been performed looking at this that have even suggested if you don't keep kids then separated from one another and from going down and hanging out at the mall, you may actually do nothing at all. In fact, transmission could actually be increased because of the mixing that occurs at the mall is greater than what would occur in a classroom. And that's very much the way we've been leaning. We've actually have a draft guideline that pretty much says what CDC ended up saying today, is that it looks like school closures are probably going to be valuable only in a very limited number of situations. And certainly system-wide closures don't make a lot of sense at all.
There is a point then, however, that could change, right? In other words, if it was discovered that the disease is highly communicable, couldn't that change?
Well, I think we know it is highly communicable, or at least as communicable as seasonal influenza is, but the disease is probably relatively mild. So that's part of what's driven this towards not worrying quite so much about schools. And the federal guidelines were very much based on their existing guidelines for school closure during seasonal influenza outbreaks. So those recommendations are out there. I mean, influenza is the Rodney Dangerfield of the infectious disease world. It doesn't get no respect. and it's, you know, and I think that's an, it's really a, an important point, because people will say, well, this is no worse than seasonal flu. Well, 36,000 people die in this country in a good year with seasonal flu. 200,000 are hospitalized, so it's a huge economic impact. We estimate anywhere from 5% to 20% of the unvaccinated population will get infected with seasonal influenza each year. So it is a highly transmissible disease, and it's not an insignificant one. So even if this strain turns out to be just like another seasonal influenza, it's not necessarily a minor event. But we rarely close schools for seasonal influenza. It's occasionally done. I know it was done in North Carolina in one county this past year because there was concern about how explosive it was. And basically, they couldn't have school very well because so many people were absent.
Pamela suggests that we're poorly prepared, and certainly we could be better prepared. But, you know, I'm thinking, even if it's not this flu, there's liable to be another flu. The bird flu is basically, it's only because it's mostly a bird thing, you know, that could mutate tomorrow, and it's already claiming human lives. Well, and that could get here, and we might have a real problem on our hands.
Well, there's lots of possible sources of pandemic strains, and certainly we've had a lot of focus on avian influenza, and particularly on the H5N1 bird flu, because it does seem to have a very high mortality. That's a virus that is not transmitted person to person except under very unusual situations. And it doesn't even seem to be transmitted from birds to people very often. But when that transmission occurs, it's really can be a devastating disease. To date, still the mortality is over 50% for that. There's a lot of work that suggests that it's unlikely that virus in its current form would become a pandemic strain. It doesn't mean it's out of the realm of possibility. And for those of us, before I was doing things like being a very much a generalist as a chief medical officer, my focus was on infectious diseases. And a number of us in the infectious disease world, we always say our worst dreams are a really virulent strain of influenza, because in general, that's a type of virus that spreads very quickly and infects people very readily. And if it has causes a severe illness, that can have a big impact. 1918 pandemic certainly is a very good example of that.
Well, I gather you're really applauding the value of this as an exercise, if nothing else, is liable to increase our preparedness.
Yeah, and there really has been a lot of work gone into preparedness. And at least according to the most recent Trust for America's Health evaluation, Alaska compared fairly well with other states. But I'm not here to defend our preparedness efforts. The attention that the bird flu drew to influenza, I think, has been very valuable and has really helped us to be prepared for this, what I believe is an evolving pandemic, and also to be prepared for other things. We work with across bureaucratic lines much more freely than we ever had before. The state, the Department of Health and Social Services activated their Emergency Operations Center a week ago today. And that became the communications hub of how information would come in, information would go out, how logistics would be organized. And then that's dovetailed yesterday into activation of the State Emergency Coordination Center. And that provides an opportunity to respond to not only the evolving influenza situation, but also a program that's called River Watch and the response to the spring breakup flooding, which really it appears to be in along the Yukon, one of the worst in recent years. And so the medical branch of that function can now address influenza, but also coordinate with questions like, well, how can people make sure their water is clean? You know, we're sure there's going to be questions about, well, how do we wash our hands if we don't have clean water once our well has been flooded? And that way, all those questions can be answered in a coordinated way.
Wow. Let's go to Kay joins the program from Juneau. Kay, you're on the air with Dr. Butler.
Hi. Thanks, Steve and Dr. Butler. I'm sick. I have the flu. I don't know what kind of flu it is. I believe that I contracted this flu in a school in Palmer where I was doing some practicum supervision. Two of the children in this classroom that I was visiting were very, very sick, and I knew that they had the flu because of the type of cough that they had. I'm a mother of grown children and have grandchildren, and I know the symptoms well. So I was very worried, and I did all of the, I think I did all of the right things. I didn't get close to them. I washed my hands very thoroughly. I didn't open the doors. I used paper towels to open the doors. And 2 days later, I was very, very sick.
Dang.
And, yeah, and I unfortunately, I had to get on a plane from Anchorage to come home, which I felt very guilty about.
Double dang.
Yeah, but I have no idea what kind of flu I have, but I have some kind of upper respiratory flu, and it's pretty uncomfortable, and now my husband has it. So the other thing I think that's meaningful for me about this is my mother's mother, my birth grandmother, died.
Whoa.
1918.
Ah, there we go.
Oh.
And left my mother and her little sister and three other children orphans. So I think that the discussion about the school closures is very relevant, but of course what concerns me is not only the fact that those parents for some reason couldn't keep their children home, but I myself couldn't really afford to stay in Anchorage, you know, longer than I did. So here I am, you know, spreading my own versions of this around the countryside. And I don't know whether I should go to the hospital and have a check or go to my health care provider and have whatever it is that they do, take a blood test or mucus or something. But, you know, I'm feeling somewhat better today, but I'm not feeling great, and I don't feel like I can go to work. So, anyway.
Thank you. That's a really great discussion. I feel like we're all just sitting around the coffee table, but I'm not going to shake hands with you.
No, or get close to me.
Dr. Butler.
But what to do is really the issue.
Yes.
And then the other situation is that I think, you know, if you can stay home, stay home, absolutely, and do everything that you can at home to make yourself feel better and rest and do all the things that we know we should do if we have a flu virus.
Yeah. But, well, I imagine Dr. Butler's going to say, yeah, you should head for the clinic or your doctor.
Well, I appreciate the report from the sick bed. That's, I think, very valuable for people to hear from someone who has influenza.
I heard about those children out in Palmer.
Yeah.
And well, I had been to several other schools in other parts of the Mat-Su and Anchorage, but there weren't any sick children in those other schools, at least that I knew of or that I had encountered or could see symptoms in. So I'm blaming them, but nevertheless, you know, it's a nasty thing. And I pretty much thought that I was invulnerable, you know, I was not vulnerable to this because I am an older person and thought that I wouldn't catch this, but I did.
Okay.
So, anyway, thanks for taking the call, and I'll just listen in.
All right, Kay, thank you.
Well, let me make a couple of comments. One is, if you really want to know for sure if this is the new flu or just the flu that was already going around, it would require a swab be performed by either a healthcare provider or by the public health nursing down in Juneau. Your recommendations for treatment sounded pretty much the same as mine. It's going to be rest. It's going to be fluids, taking over-the-counter analgesics, anti-fever medications are appropriate. With one exception, we advise people to stay away from aspirin, and that's particularly important for children under the age of 18 because of the risk of Reye syndrome, which is a fairly rare but devastating complication that can occur in children who have a number of viral infections, including influenza, when they receive aspirin. Kay didn't mention if she'd received the flu vaccine or not.
I have a feeling she didn't are
pretty good that it was seasonal flu, but I can't say for sure, certainly, but that may be something that she'll want to be thinking about for next year. Of course, the response that I hear from many people is, well, I get the vaccine and it gave me the flu. Biologically, that's impossible, but it does describe something that's very real, is that there are other respiratory viruses that will make you sick. Fortunately, the circulating strains of influenza, at least the ones represented in the vaccine, are not one of them.
This H1N1 2009, they say they're working on a vaccine, and it takes a certain length of time, apparently, before... I mean, you don't just come up with a vaccine. You actually have to breed it or something?
Yeah, it requires time to develop the virus, which has been isolated. And in fact, the genome of some of the original isolates were posted to the internet on April 24th. So it's already out there in the public domain. I mean, that's sort of the amazing aspect of the response that probably wouldn't have even been feasible 5 or 6 years ago.
Entrepreneurs can go to work on it.
Absolutely. So I'm sure there's a lot of biotechs looking at this right
now.
The production of the vaccine, though, is something that still takes a period of a number of months. And once the vaccine's available, there would certainly be testing to determine whether or not the antibody levels appear to be adequate. Is it safe? Before it was used in a mass vaccination campaign. I think the very earliest we could look at would probably be September, if we were looking at a specific vaccine for this virus.
Dr. Jay Butler is our guest on Talk of Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority.
Dr. Jay Butler is the Chief Medical Officer for the state of Alaska. We're talking about the H1N1 swine flu, H1N1 2009. And so far, there are no cases confirmed in the state of Alaska. There are a number of people who are calling with exactly the same question, and you will probably not be surprised by this. But we have seasonal workers that are coming in because the fish are coming in. And they're wondering, is there some kind of screening that could be done?
Well, screening can be done, but it's not probably what most people are thinking. The screening is identifying people who have influenza symptoms and being able to provide for them an area where they can be isolated from people who are well. In a, say, a dormitory-type situation on a land-based say a cannery industrial situation where you have migrant workers coming in. Oftentimes they're staying in dormitories. If you can designate some rooms where sick workers can stay until they've recuperated and be separate from people who are sick, that's very important. It's also critical that hand hygiene facilities and supplies be available and that the education on respiratory etiquette be provided as well. We hope to have some very specific recommendations for Alaska on this issue on our website, pandemicflu.alaska.gov, very soon. And actually just today, some federal guidelines came out from the CDC on this topic as well.
It is amazing how it's changing sometimes hourly, and the web does allow you to keep up with this so much better than printed material, which would be rendered obsolete after a day or two. We have an email from Tom who says, healthy people should avoid groups of people when they can during outbreaks. In addition to trying not to touch my eyes and nose with my hands, I have trained myself to use my left hand to open doors, etc. I'm right-handed, so I do touch my face. It's likely to be with that hand. By golly, there's a rule of thumb.
Yeah, that's excellent advice. When we talk about the importance of hand hygiene, that the virus can stay viable for a period of minutes on the hands, obviously it doesn't become airborne from your hands, but you do reach up, and if you rub your fingers into your eyes or wipe your nose, that provides an opportunity to inoculate the virus into the mucous membranes.
What are the guidelines on the flu shot? Is there any percentage in getting the flu shot even now?
On the level of uptake?
Well, you were talking about, the older people are more at risk. Younger people are more at risk. There is the flu shot from last fall.
Sure.
Is there still a percentage in getting a flu shot now?
In terms of any indication for getting it now, I guess I would make two comments, maybe actually three. Even though the vaccine is generally available, it may not be available everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We're at the tail end of the influenza season. So if you can find it, it may be worth getting it. It certainly would provide protection against the seasonal flu, although that protection won't kick in for another 10 days or so. The other is we don't yet know that the current vaccine provides any protection against this strain of H1N1. That's being studied very closely right now, particularly in Texas. There's a study going on.
Good point, because it was discovered that the test appears to work for it.
Yes. And it also raises that question of why do we not yet see older people being infected very often?
Yeah.
A couple of things. There may be the fact that still much of the epidemic is driven by travel into the country and then spread through the schools, and it just hasn't reached the elderly population yet. Another possibility is that the elders are immune for whatever reason. It's thought to be unlikely due to the seasonal flu vaccine that they may be more likely to have gotten last fall. But if they were alive before 1957, they may have been exposed to the H1N1 that was the predominant circulating strain up until that year. And that virus was actually the descendant from the 1918 pandemic strain. So it is possible, perhaps, that there's still enough immunity from very early in life that people over age 53, which includes some people who aren't so very old.
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
Would be protected. A third possibility is 45 million Americans actually received the swine flu vaccine in 1976. That was a very different situation. That was not a pandemic. In fact, there was never even any community transmission of that virus. The vaccination program certainly had problems in and of itself, but there may actually be some protection still provided from that vaccine. We don't know the answer. Those are all hypotheses that I offer.
Well, I wish we could do a lightning round, but we only got a minute left. Let's give it to Will in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. You're on the air with Dr. Butler.
Oh, hello, Dr. Butler.
Hi, Will.
I was reading somewhere of a study they did with how long virus survives at different temperatures. And they were talking about temperatures, you know, if you're like 20 degrees centigrade, you know, in the above 68, that the virus doesn't survive very long at all in the open. And that when you get down to, say, around 40 degrees Fahrenheit, it...
Okay, let's give him a few seconds to answer the question.
Yeah, in general, the virus is going to survive better at lower temperatures, drier conditions, and on solid surfaces rather than porous surfaces.
Wow. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the program today. Is there a, you know, we seem to get the flu in Alaska different than they do in other places. Is there any chance that we catch Asian flus earlier than the rest of the country, and that our flu shots are coming too late?
Well, in terms of seasonal flu, no. We have our vaccines the same time as everybody else, and it seems to work as well in Alaska as it does anywhere in the country.
I see.
Do sometimes tend to get it a little later. Sometimes we get it earlier, but most of the time we seem to get it a little later.
Well, thank you very much. I hope we don't have to have you back on the program again too soon, Dr. Butler. You've been a great guest.
All right. Thank you.
All right, next week it's going to be energy. Gooseberry Peter at the controls, Len Anderson on the phones, Pat Yak in charge. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Communications Systems, serving Alaskans across the state with vital telecommunications since before statehood. ACS, providing voice and high-speed broadband solutions, connects Alaska to the rest of the world. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.